Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, delivering clarity in a world of constant noise. We go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead of the stories that matter. Here's what to look forward to on the show today. Higher custom tariffs on roughly 60 countries dubbed the worst offenders are due to come into effect today. We speak to Professor Patrick Bond, Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Johannesburg. We take a look at deepfakes and how they can lead to unrest, financial fraud and reputational damage in South Africa. Borlandi Tebe, Security Lead at Accenture Africa. We also take a look at safety online for South Africa's children. 95% of them are online. Chief Information Officer at RCS, Leon Jacobs, is standing by to help us make sense of that. And South Africa's youth, are they prepared for the world of work? We're going to be speaking to Janice Robson, Business Development Head at FNB.
MoneyWeb at Midday, for all your up-to-date stories.
On the 2nd of April 2025, a day Donald Trump declared Liberation Day, the President of the United States announced a swathe of economic tariffs on the entire world, which sent global stock markets into a tailspin. America wants to bring production home, secure supply chains, and make America great again. You would have heard that time and again. Higher custom tariffs on roughly 60 countries dubbed the worst offenders are due to come into effect today, the 9th of April. Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Johannesburg, Professor Patrick Bond, joins us now to take a look at the effects on you and I. And before we do that, Prof, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Let's take a look at whether there is a point to be made that in some deals where America was trading with some of its partners, it was not all that fair. And so this is also done in the name of rebalancing that. Is there a point to be made there?
Not really. I mean, I think when you say unfair, the typical example might be a zero tariff on goods imported to the U.S. And the most explicit example is the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. But, you know, what's fair? The exploitation of Africa, when we go back to slavery, colonialism, neocolonialism, U.S. support for the apartheid government, certainly needs reparations. So the AGOA was meant to be one way. The thing is that it really affected mostly the big corporates that had the economies of scale and the ability to export to the U.S. So the biggest example would be oil companies from Angola or from South Africa, big German luxury automobile companies, Mercedes especially, or for steel, that's ArcelorMittal based in Luxembourg. We know they're closing their foundries, or for aluminium, BHP Billiton. They've been getting, or another one, Sasol for petrochems, and big plantations for horticulture, for nuts, vineyards, again, white owned. So I think, you know, there's a real question about, you know, sort of what is fair, given that the beneficiaries of those zero tariffs were actually the big corporates from the West. And this isn't something I'm uniquely aware of. Even in the US, they're saying, let's not mess with AGOA because it's helping our friends. You see that in reports from this Hudson Institute. Mm. I think what is fair is to ask, can you have a more balanced economy by having a better spread of your economic activity from manufacturing? We ask that all the time. We put on tariffs, for example, against the Chinese regularly. The International Trade Administration Commission, ITAC, is very, very active in trying to defend our small industries from dumping. So I think this is something, when you say fair, it's fair to put on tariffs. John Maynard Keynes, the greatest economist of the 20th century, was very much in favor of tariffs and avoiding international trade if you can keep your economy balanced.
Mm. So South African goods entering the U.S. are now subject to a 30% tariff with a specific 25% tariff imposed on vehicles and car parts. It is interesting to note that key mineral exports such as platinum, group metals, coal, gold, manganese and chrome have been excluded from these new tariffs. What does that tell us? Does it also give South Africa leverage?
Not really. I think that puts us back again into neo-colonial arrangement, which the U.S. is certainly happy to have. That is to take cheap imports from all over Africa that are in these categories of the raw materials, and then to sell back the finished goods. Of course, that's the that's the standard system that colonialism had imposed. And of course, neo-colonial arrangements have generally amplified that. I would include Chinese capital as a sort of middleman in this, because they're also sending back finished goods, but they're also sending African minerals secondhand now to the U.S. via their own processing plants. And that global value chain, that is the interconnectedness of big corporates, the fact that an iPhone is originally got fingerprints of child workers in Chinese mines in the Eastern DRC, and then it's sort of stolen through Rwanda, then it goes to the Chinese East Coast, where workers are so unhappy, the Foxconn plants of Apple, that they commit suicide. There's no unions allowed. And then that very, very cheap process, child labor, environmental exploitation and depletion of natural resources, denial of royalties to the DRC, and then worker exploitation, all the profits end up going to Cupertino, California for Apple. And I think that is what is ultimately unfair. And Donald Trump wouldn't dare acknowledge that, because he's made good friends with the leaders of Apple, who are part and parcel of his sort of big data turn in the past few months. And Elon Musk is the one most, I think, hit by this. He's lost more money personally than anyone over the last week. That's because he's importing massive amounts of that cobalt and coltan from the Eastern DRC via, you know, the battery plants in China into his Tesla cars in Texas and California. So he's the one facing the most contradictions. He's the one who's angriest about this. He's called Trump's trade advisor, Peter Navarro, a moron in the last couple of days. I think this is one of the most interesting splits within the Trump regime, between the free marketeers and these protectionists.
Let's take a look, listen at this, Prof. This is what we heard from Donald Trump, because the buzzword right now is protectionist policies, but the U.S. is saying, well, we want to reindustrialize, without saying it. They want to bring production home. Here's what we've heard about how it's going so far.
So that whole situation that, you know, there was, it was somewhat explosive, but if we didn't do that, we wouldn't be talking the way we're talking right now. It's been amazing what's happened. Sometimes you have to mix it up a little bit, but we've had great great consideration. We've had talks with many, many countries, over 70. They all want to come in. Our problem is can't see that many that fast. But we don't have to, because, as you know, the tariffs are on and the money is pouring in at a level that we've never seen before.
Prof, a new world economic order taking shape already?
I think it is, because Trump could only be merely using these very high tariffs that he's announced to negotiate and to do one-on-one trade deals. And so we go back to some sort of normality in international trade. On the other hand, if China really is serious about a trade war, and if the WTO, World Trade Organization, is as disempowered now as it appears, yes, we're way beyond that era of corporate globalization. We're into a very brutal imperial order where the U.S. uses its remaining power. And now I think also risks the loss of soft power. It's completely destroyed its goodwill on healthcare, on climate, you know, by being climate denialist, by shutting down programs that may kill millions of people. So I think if you're in the U.S. and you want to have a sort of broad-based imperial control of the world, which you know, worked very well, especially after the Soviet Union collapsed, you're going to be very worried about Donald Trump's self-destructiveness.
I heard a little bit earlier on, or my key takeaway a little bit earlier on, is that it would appear that history is repeating itself where the African continent is concerned, at least, or there's parts of it, or there appears to be hallmarks of history repeating itself. And so, Professor Patrick Bond, what then happens? Because you've got a delegation from Lesotho immediately going to America, South African delegation going to America, see what the Zimbabweans have done in response to this. And so what does this opportunity, or is it even an opportunity, what does it present for the African continent? What to do here? Do we diversify? Do we choose different partners? The EU is South Africa's biggest trading partner. So what do we do?
Yes, all of those things, but actually to not be simply cowards. This is a point where there are two major forces in the G20. the African Union, which was invited in 2023, and the host this year, which is South Africa. I think voting Donald Trump off the G20 island now becomes one of the logical ways to find unity amongst everyone else. I don't think, aside from the Argentine president, Javier Milei, maybe Giorgia Meloni from Italy, I don't think Trump has any friends in the G20. And that would be one way to sort of get progress going and put not just some countervailing trade sanctions, but more general BDS, boycott, divestment sanctions against the Trump regime. They have to get some punishment. And that would mean, I think, you know, really beefing up the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice, to prosecute U.S. war crimes, such as the support for the Israeli genocide or the bombing now of Yemenis. These are the sorts of things that should be in the public discussion, because Trump's taken it as far as you can go. I don't know if he can punish us anymore. He's just destroyed AGOA, taken away U.S. aid funding, and even dismissed the sort of military relationship, as weak as that was. So I think the ties between the U.S. and South Africa are basically finished. So it's time for, I think, a South African and African Union offensive.
Thank you very much, Prof, for your contribution this afternoon. Professor of Sociology at the University of Johannesburg, Professor Patrick Bond.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Misinformation and disinformation has been on the rise in South Africa, presenting challenges to our closely held democratic principles. Deepfake technology is a type of artificial intelligence used to create convincing fake images, video and audio recordings. The lines have been increasingly blurred, and without a disclaimer by the poster of deepfake content, one can barely tell fiction from fact. Deepfakes could lead to political unrest and financial fraud. To weigh in on this, we are joined by Boerland Ditebe. He's a security lead at Accenture Africa. Thank you very much, sir, for your time this afternoon. When we talk about misinformation and disinformation, what are the particular consequences of it on a democratic country, for instance, like South Africa?
I think the consequences can be dire. We have seen here in South Africa 2 years ago when there were riots, mostly or instigated to some extent through social media, where people were posting and encouraging others to continue with the destruction of property and setting businesses on fire. Now, if we take that a step further, if you think about if there is a leader in South Africa who has got a following that could be, or their voices and images are faked, and the pronounce on incitement of violence against the certain groups in the country, that can let South Africa on fire. We are a very young democracy, very fragile. And it's not only in South Africa, by the way. There are many other areas where this could cause serious stability within countries.
Is there a legal framework known to you, at least, that South Africa relies on when it comes to the regulation of artificial intelligence in the country?
Not at this stage. I don't think there is any specific legislation as it relates to artificial intelligence. And I think you're raising a very important point there around artificial intelligence and linking it to deepfakes, right? There is a study that was done by Alignment Research Center. It's a research group around ChatGPT-4. And what they did is they gave this agent, AI agent, a task to do. I don't know if you are aware of the CAPTCHA, the security mechanism that's used to tell robots and humans apart. So they gave this computer a CAPTCHA puzzle to resolve. And over many tries, it failed to resolve that. It eventually came up with its own plan, not the researchers giving it information on how to solve it. And it used another technique called social engineering. It's part of the things that we deal with in information security. Social engineering, which is to call an agent and pretend that they are visually impaired. So this AI agent calls a human, pretending to be a human, and that they are visually impaired and that they cannot solve the CAPTCHA quiz. And the human, not knowing any better, gave the computer the right solution to the CAPTCHA, and they managed to break that security control. So this goes to show how dangerous, as we move into the AI world, how deepfakes can destroy confidence in businesses, confidence in governments, and a person-to-person relationships.
Hmm. Does that then not mean that we do need to be more urgent about the regulation of artificial intelligence? Yes, South Africa is not the exception to the rule when it comes to not having a legal framework. Well, the European Union, a bloc like the European Union in 2024, they were said to be the first in the world to come up with a legal framework. They've since faced backlash, right? There was an AI summit as well that took place earlier this year, but the tone of that is that, well, we are not ready because we don't want to suppress artificial intelligence and where we could go with that.
Yeah, and I think it's cautionary from regulators that they how they're approaching this, because one, you know, we're not at the stage where AI is matured to a point where we can, or where the regulators can come with a set of regulations to protect citizenry. That's one view of it. Yes, at some point, the regulations will be developed. But on the other hand, right, there will always be the dark side of AI where people are transgressing regulations to their nefarious ends. So I think it has to be a two-pronged approach. One, yes, we need to regulate how businesses should protect or guide businesses on how to use AI. Because remember where this comes from, right? I have a lot of my information, biometric information, stored at banks, at my employer, and so on and so forth. And this is how these deepfakes combined with AI becomes dangerous. If that information is not well protected, it becomes even more dangerous, because now these AI bots can now access legit, correct information about a person and pretend to be that person. They know my ID number, they know my home address, they know all the things there is to know about me to be able to dupe a bank to authorize a transaction, including using my voice, because now they can even correctly mimic my voice. So I guess what I'm trying to say is there are regulations today, for example, Protection of Personal Information Act, that should be beefed up with other regulations to further protect the citizenry against the challenges and risks introduced by AI.
Because it touches on every aspect of our lives. I think the other day I was reading an article about how South Africa is also taking a look at the higher education space, where they're finding more and more learners are using artificial intelligence to come up with their research papers, which could ultimately alter our research trajectory as a country. And so I guess the final question to you, sir, is that as not only businesses, but you've got the higher education space, you've got the security element of all this. Are we prepared as a country, would you say, according to your analysis?
I don't think we are particularly prepared. But at the same time, we are not at the bottom end of preparedness. I think organizations, big business, is fully aware of the steps they need to do to protect information that could be used in deepfakes and so on and so forth. But at the same time, it's not a solace to see the breaches continuing. We saw that a credit bureau last year or 2 years back was compromised. Your ID number does not change. Mm. The fact that it's 2 years ago does not change anything. The fact that information is still out there and could be used by others for nefarious purposes, right? Mm. So I don't think we are ready. Business is making strides into the right direction, but we still have a long way to go.
Mr. Ditebe, sir, thank you very much for your contribution. Boland Ditebe is security lead at Accenture.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
It is not unusual to see a toddler on their parents' or even their own gadget glued to the screen. And if that is unusual, try getting the attention of a teenager who's on their phone for hours on end. Over 95% of South African children access the internet on a daily basis, oblivious to cyber threats. Here's some shocking information for you. Research shows that 25% of children worldwide have added people they do not know to their friends list, and 18% have sent either a photo or a video of themselves to strangers. Leon Jacobs is Chief Information Officer at RCS, and he joins us now to help us better protect our children online. Leon, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. Let's talk about the rise of online scams. What are some of the common scams targeting children and teenagers?
Good afternoon, Dudu, and good afternoon to your listeners. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. Yes, we definitely have seen a rise in online fraud in recent years, and simply because many of our kids are spending a lot of time online in terms of the interactions via social media and through games. And some of the vectors, as we call it, that these scamsters use are things like fake competitions. They have things like model agency scams. What we've seen as a credit provider is sometimes our information is impersonated. So these are some of the key typical trends that we're seeing as the type of scams that are being perpetrated.
So it's gone beyond the click the like, subscribe and comment button to sophisticated trickery for young people. What then do we do as parents? Some of your guidelines for making our children tech savvy?
Yes. So I think there definitely is a responsibility on parents to be actively involved and engaged with their children in terms of what they do online. You have to have an adult conversation with your kids, whether it is a toddler, whether it is a teenager, to talk about some of the dangers of being exposed online. I think if you look at some of the cases we've seen around cyberbullying, around personal information being leaked and kids being exposed online, I think really parents have to be very, very, very open with their children, not in an accusatory way, but in an adult way, to talk to them about making them understand that if they share personal information, you know, whether it is personal information about you, whether it is things like your address, your email address, your telephone number, or whether they share personal pictures, for example, that those elements could be used by third parties and fraudsters to create havoc for you in your life, you know. And I think really it is incumbent upon parents to be quite open and frank with their kids about the dangers of being online.
Absolutely. So keeping your personal information private is very important. And then there is a risk that your child might shop on a site that is not secure. What do we do then to circumvent that, if you will?
So you need to look out for certain triggers. So the one is typically if an offer seems to be too good to be true, then it typically is. Number two, if you have unsolicited emails, WhatsApp messages, unsolicited DMs, whether it is on Instagram or on TikTok, for example, please be sure that you check and verify these websites. If you are looking for a financial services product, for example, rather go and do your own research, go to those websites yourself, go to the social media sites of these companies yourself, and rather follow that channel. But anything that's unsolicited, that you haven't asked for, that seems too good to be true, that typically would be some of the triggers. And then also, when you get an email, when you are browsing social media sites, make sure that you check the links. Check that it's HTTPS, in other words, that the content is encrypted. So those are some of the basic things that one can do. But ultimately, you just have to be very, very diligent.
If we suspect fraudulent activity, where do we report it to?
So we do have from an RCS perspective, you can contact us and let us know directly. We've got a fully bona fide fraud department that will investigate these options. But there are also SAPS crime channels that one can follow. There's the crime stop number. There's a SAPS emergency number. There's a fraud and anti-corruption hotline number that one can follow. So the first port of call is to go to the financial institution where you have products and let them know. But you also then have an obligation to register these cases with the police services.
What have you noted, Leon, is the recourse tangible? So how many people, it doesn't really have to be specific, but people that reported versus, you know, the positive outcomes that they're actually looking for. Do people win these cases? Do people get their monies back?
Look, so we can't comment for other financial institutions. We can't also comment on the success rate with the South African police services. But I can guarantee you, if somebody lodges an incident or case with us as a business, with RCS, We do a detailed investigation. If it does come to light that it has been fraud and your account has been taken over somehow by a third party or fraudster, we will ensure that you are reimbursed. So if you can prove to us and we have evidence that this transaction is legitimately fraud, then we will definitely reimburse you as a customer.
Do you need to be an RCS cardholder or member?
So RCS as a business, so if you have any one of our financial services products, whether it is credit card, a retail loan, a cash loan, or a store card, and there's been an incident on any one of the products with us as a business, we will definitely reimburse you.
Mm. Just before we let you go, Leon, strong passwords, how important is that? We always hear it, right? But we then go and we just use not so strong passwords because it's easy to remember.
Yes, it is very important. So typically what we do internal to the organization, we have a password complexity standard that we set. So anyone logging onto any of our systems, you have to meet the password complexity and the password length requirement. And that's simply because if you have what we call an easily guessable password, it is very, very easy for a fraudster to then figure out what that password could be. So typically people use, you know, the name of their spouse, the name of their partner with, some numerical digits or the name of their pet or a birth date. And there is software out there now that is sophisticated where it can pick up on some of these elements so that it knows about you from a social media perspective. And it then works out what it thinks the password could be. And that's how these passwords are exposed. So for us, we want our customers to be safe out there. So password complexity is very, very important because the more complex the password is and the longer the password is, the more difficult it will be for a third party or a hacker to work out and figure out what that password is.
Hmm.
What we also do advise our customers on is that, you know, apart from the password complexity, what you should have is what we call two-factor authentication. So, you know, if you think about Gmail, for example, you can set up two-factor authentication where there's a second authentication factor like a USSD or a one-time PIN that's sent as an SMS that really is a second level of protection. So it's not just the password, it's a combination of your password and then a second factor.
Absolutely. Leon, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Leon Jacobs is Chief Information Officer at RCS.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's educational outcomes, are they preparing our children for the future that is already unfolding before them? You need only think of artificial intelligence. And so we take a look at this with Janice Robson. She's Business Development Head at FNB. They also have the FNB App Academy, which is designed to solve the skills mismatch between what learners are taught and what reality holds. Janice, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. And that's the question, right? Our educational outcomes, do they prepare young people for what's ahead of them?
Good afternoon, Dudu, and thank you for that question. There are significant mismatches between the skills taught in schools and the demands of the job market, particularly in the tech sector. Rapid technology advancements have shifted the focus to skills such as software development, coding skills, data analysis, cloud computing, and cybersecurity, as these skills are increasingly sought after by employers. This mismatch contributes to high unemployment as the educational system struggles to adapt to the evolving demands of industry. The FNB App Academy's role addresses this gap by offering targeted training in coding, software development, and full-stack development. The graduates of this program gain practical experience in languages like Python and JavaScript, closing this gap between education and industry needs.
Mm. When you take a look at the young people that have gone through your program, how do you measure the success, right? More so when we look at their future. So do they get into industries that they are being trained for?
So yes, Dudu, we do have success stories that we could relate to you in terms of how it is that we measure the success of this campaign. The program offers hands-on and practical skills in terms of tech development. And so through the program and the mentorship that's available, graduates are taught practical, critical thinking skills as well as problem-solving skills to be able to equip them to be employable and ready to start on day one.
Zimbabwean millionaire. That's what we always refer to him. Zimbabwean millionaire, Mr. Strive Masiwa. He's building an artificial intelligence factory in South Africa, and that's something that is coming up in the long term, right? So when you take a look at things like that, where we have actual factories that we can manufacture goods so we can offer the world something as a continent, are you looking maybe at partnering up and taking some of your learners to and speaking to people who are doing work like this, where children can actually make something that they can offer the world?
At this stage, Dudu, we're not exploring any partnership opportunities. The focus for F&B at this point in time is to ensure that we close the skills gap that we see by equipping these graduates with globally competitive skills that they can then transfer directly into employment opportunities as well as entrepreneurship opportunities. The academy plays a role in retaining this talent and fostering innovation within the country. The graduates don't only help bolster South Africa's economic growth, but it also adds to digital transformation and contributing directly to this industry. We are able to set ourselves up as a tech hub in South Africa.
What would it take to close the gap?
I think that we need to have a deliberate and dedicated focus between private and public institutions to be able to radically change the education system to incorporate the required skills for the fourth industrial revolution from early grades of school, teaching the basics of coding, software development, cybersecurity, etc., and foster that environment from an early age so that by the time these individuals are ready to graduate into tertiary education, they have the foundational elements to set them up for success.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time, Janice, this afternoon. Janice Robson is Business Development Head at F&B. That's MoneyWeb at midday for today. Do join us again tomorrow for more insights shaping the country and the future. Jeremy Maggs is back with you.